Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, and I'm founder and CEO of the City's First podcast. And I'm very excited to have a range of guests that are going to cover pretty much everything related to resilience, mobility, and how to plan for cities that will take us through the next century. And it's really exciting to hear from a range of perspectives in Europe and North America around this topic. The actual title of our webinar today is Designing Resilient Cities Strategies for a Future Ready Urban World. And this is sponsored today by PTV Group and Econolite Umovity. So we're really excited to have a panel of guests here to talk about these topics. First, we have Matthias Frim, a senior product manager with the PTV Group in Karlsruhe, Germany. Welcome, Matthias.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
And next, we also have Mike Dang, who's a product manager, NEMA, with the Econolite from Anaheim, California in the U.S. Welcome, Mike.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I did my master's program in transportation management, so this is a topic that's very dear to my heart.
Yes, and I'm an urban planner myself, so we have lots to talk about here, so we're going to deep dive. If we have an opportunity to perhaps have one or two more speakers join during the conversation, we'll kind of open up the panel. But for now, we'll just kind of kick off and talk about this topic of designing resilient cities strategies for a future-ready urban world. Maybe we'll just kick it off with the first topic, which is just defining what is resilient city. So I'll kind of tee this off to you, Matthias, for the first kind of question, which is, what does resilience mean for cities today? What, in your view, just from a very broad perspective, how would you define that? And there's no right or wrong answer.
Yeah, there are many definitions. I would say quite generally, it's about avoiding any kind of vulnerability to the city and the citizens. And before going into resilience, I would first start with a less en vogue word of just robustness, because of course, that's the general foundation. And there are quite simple examples of robust structure, for example, when you define something is robust, that means it's strong and unlikely to fail. Then taking your power line, for example, and burying it in the ground, that's a very robust approach, because you won't have any trees falling on it. You won't have any impact of storm, of ice on it. So basically, you can say a buried line in the ground is not affected by weather. So this kind of robustness is definitely a good foundation also for any kind of resilience thinking. And when we think about transportation networks, then being robust, that also means that you don't operate at the edge of your capacity. You can have alternative routes, you have a well-connected transportation network. And that means if in a situation one route is maybe blocked through a breakdown vehicle, you can just accept that more easily when you have alternative routes that make the traffic still flow. But coming back to resilience, yeah, there are many definitions, but I like the one that is also adapted from the National Academy of Science that says the ability of a system to prepare and plan for, absorb, recover from, and more successful adapt to adverse events. So we are talking about something bad happening, and two key elements from my perspective. One is, of course, preparation and planning. So being resilient means you have to think ahead, you have to build scenarios, you need to make plans, run simulations, ask about all the what ifs to help to improve that adverse event doesn't make such a dent when it hits on your system. And the second thing is, of course, that recovery idea. So once you have the dent in your system performance, it's about bouncing back. So how fast are you in setting up reactions, in adapting to make sure that you can come back to at least the system performance you had? And I personally also like the idea of not only bouncing back, but maybe even bounce forward or bounce ahead. So you want to adopt, you want to learn from what happened, you want to take that into your plans, into your scenarios, and make sure that you are better prepared for the next effect or for the next event that could happen in the future.
So resiliency is not just about recovery, but it's also proactive and forward thinking. So it could be sustainable and additive, not just a replacement for what was lost before. I think that's a key takeaway from what I hear from you, Matthew. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on the same topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think Matthias kind of hits the nail on the head there. And to add a little bit onto that, I mean, there's really no preventing disruptions from happening, right? There's going to be earthquakes, there's going to be floodings, there's going to be hurricanes. But like where we were talking about, it's about how we respond to those, and not only how we respond, but how we be proactive about it, right? We don't want to go through the same cycle every year, right? It's hurricane season, you get a bunch of equipment knocked out, and then you replace it next season, it all happens again. How do we prevent that? How do we make sure that, when we're replacing it, we're thinking about a design that, that this keeps happening. How do we replace this, but do it in a way where it doesn't happen so that we don't have to spend all this capital every year, replacing traffic cabinets that get flooded, during hurricane season? It's a lot of wasted money that could be spent making the system more robust, more resilient. Building smarter, I think, is one of the key things to being resilient.
Or you're based in Southern California. I'm from LA, so we can talk about fire season. We can talk about what
Yeah,
happened
absolutely.
in Los Angeles with the Palisades fire and the Eaton fire, which was not too far from where I grew up in Pasadena, in Altadena, California. So the level of destruction in the San Gabriel Mountains and the Santa Monica Mountains was just nothing we've seen probably on this scale in the last century. Although fires are part of the natural ecology of coastal and Southern California and Mediterranean climate, of course. However, this kind of fire zone interface between urban, suburban, and these, let's say, wilderness environments, whether they be protected or not, is something that gives us cause for, I would say, concern and rethinking land use, the built environment, and how do we rebuild, or quote Pete Buttigieg, do we build back better? Do we build at all? I mean, do we really want to build in these urban fire zone interfaces? Because it's been mapped quite frequently in the state of California. I saw a very interesting map. I was a former cartographer myself for many years, so I'm very akin to these types of visualizations. And just seeing that broad swath of the danger zone as a ring around the Los Angeles basin and around kind of south and central Orange County, and then a ring all the way around the San Joaquin Valley and around central central California from the coastal range over to the Sierra Nevadas, these are areas that, by definition, should be considered no-build zones or low-build zones. And we need to kind of rethink about those, whether they are specific tools, technology, processes that can help us rethink not only for resilience, but building smarter and better, is what Matthew said and what you're saying for hurricane season. I just use that fire analogy because it's really prescient in California throughout the state. And it was a huge disaster in the city of Los Angeles that I've never seen in my lifetime as a native Angeleno. So it's time to rethink how we build.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go along with that, not only thinking about how we build or if we should build, being resilient, I think we got to kind of also think outside the box. What's causing these fires and how do we go back? And is there a way we can prevent them altogether? Is there anything we can do? Are there technologies that have emerged since the last fire that we can, put into use to see what's causing these areas to be high risk areas? Should we be planting more greeneries instead of having all these dry shrubs everywhere that are susceptible to burning, right? So
Yeah,
there's a lot of
yeah.
ways to go about it
Certain tree
outside of just
species.
design, but
Yeah.
we got to kind of look at it all, right? In order to be a resilient city, in order to make sure that everything works the way it's supposed to work and humanity can thrive there, we got to look at it and attack it from all angles.
Just to go down the
I
rabbit
think,
hole. Oh, sorry, go on, my bad.
yeah, I just wanted to say that that's a very a crucial point. I mean, thinking forward and also maybe not like sitting the rabbit, like the rabbit in front of the snake, not doing nothing, just waiting for the next thing to happen, but really be able to make conscious decisions. And I get it that people still like to live in that area and they want to rebuild and so on, but at least planning and foresight and scenarios, they make it possible to give kind of an evaluation of to make it an informed decision if you want to take the risk. And then, of course, you can run the mitigation strategy to level down that risk as much as possible. But especially when we're talking about fires, that also brings one other component to mobility, I would say. I mean, for such a disruption through nature, you can lose lots of utilities. You can lose your fresh water supply, your wastewater. You can use electric power. You can lose whatever. But when you lose the ability to move and to leave, that may be quickly the question for life and death. So that is the very critical situation. You can make, let's say, your basement full with a food supply that doesn't turn bad and have fresh water for the next 3 weeks. But you can't take that last part of mobility that you need for evacuation. So that is extremely precious in comparison to the others.
Yeah, and we saw that in LA just several months ago, you know, in terms of how mobility was impacted in several communities that were isolated and didn't have access to essential services and infrastructure. One final point, and I'll go on, is Mike, you made a really interesting point about kind of habitat and species and specific tree species that could help or harm kind of this urban fire interface. And one species that comes to mind that is kind of a super spreader that we have planted for over a century in Southern California are eucalyptus, which were imported from Australia. And those only exacerbate the fire danger in a lot of these zones. And originally they were used for the construction of railroads and streetcars in Los Angeles and Orange County over 100 years ago. But that's something that one example that we need to rethink too in terms of the actual habitat and the species that could help or harm how to address and mitigate the danger for fires and other natural disasters in the future. But with that, we'll just kind of move on to the next topic here. I thought this was super interesting. But maybe coming back to the definition of resilient cities, Matthias, maybe if you could give us some perspectives in terms of where you see a resilient city with respect to urban planning, technology, and climate. So how would these particular, let's say, domains be positioned such that a resilient city could actually be broadened to a more interesting use case as we move forward?
I would maybe first differentiate between stressors like heat or let's say rising sea level that maybe come slowly, and then of course shocks like a hurricane or a fire that just hits. And of course you can see that heat, for example, needs a lot of adaption if you want to keep the different modes of transport alive. So we see it in Australia, for example, that you have lots of shaded pathways for the pedestrians to make sure that they can walk safely. I experienced it in Dubai for the ITS World Congress that you have kilometers that you can walk in climatized areas that you can still move around as a pedestrian, and you don't have to get into the car because they basically built like a tunnel to shelter you from the external. So that is one possibility to address that. But of course, on the other side, you also have direct impacts on the infrastructure. So you can foresee that beyond a certain level of heat, maybe your tarmac or asphalt is soft, or maybe your rails start to bend. So that is the level of disruption that you could foresee more easily. Or rising sea level, what do you do with port areas? What do you do with bridges and so on? And in terms of those shocks that hit, then it's of course a lot about how flexible you are in a network. So what I already said, when you have a very well intertwined system, and maybe let's say your subway system is flooded a little bit because there was heavy rain, but still people can easily change to other modes, then you keep mobility alive. When you have blocks that are crucial, then of course it's the question how to get your first responders there quickly. So then we are talking about the really tactical measures like prioritization of first responder vehicles, making sure that they access and to remove those blocks as fast as possible. So I think there are many, many different perspectives you can take, from the individual traffic accident or a very local site, up to one big event like a hurricane that hits a region, up to a general trend like the earth heating up, that would ask for different measures for mitigation. The good thing is, I think investment in technology and planning and infrastructure for such a smart and resilient city, that is an investment that doesn't only pay off on the day of the disaster, but you also perceive the positive effects in everyday operation. So I would say there's a very good return on invest in terms like insurance that would help you on the worst day, but still pays off during the good days as well.
It's a great point you make. And Mike, I'd love to get your perspective too, but just really quickly around kind of the short-term, near-term shocks and more of the long-tail events that kind of, let's say, creep up over a longer period of time. And what are the different mitigation, planning, and resiliency strategy measures that can be used, whether it's Hurricane Sandy back in 2012, 20, whatever, 11, to the firestorm, to long-range climate change and sea level rise, to maybe perhaps the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore last year, you know, to a range of events. So, you know, Mike, what are your some of your thoughts on this topic?
So I think for me personally, when we talk about resiliency and how to deal with the stressors and events, one of the key components is the transportation network, right? I think like in the city, the transportation network is the heart and soul of civilization, right? If you're not able to move goods and people, you're not able to get first responders where they need to go quickly, you're going to struggle with resiliency. So that's the first area of focus on, right? Make sure the transportation system is robust. Make sure we're using equipment out there that's, UL listed from an ISO certified company, that, are built to design, are designed and built to withstand the environment that they're used in. And to be smart about how you're installing them. If you're in a high flood area, don't be putting equipment that's susceptible to water on the ground all the time, right? Let's mount them on a pole, get them higher up out of the way so that they're not being destroyed year in and year out. And aside from that, I really like the fact that we're starting to see a lot of agencies, cities, states, put positions of resilient officers in place. There are a couple agencies that now have chief resilient officers whose sole job is to, look at the design of their city. How do we, mitigate a lot of these disruptions that happen to us, and how do we design better? So I think we're starting to finally focus on what's important city-wise, and I'm hoping that it starts to spread long term. And if every agency, every city has a resiliency position, I think we'll be off to a great start, because then at that point we're no longer just looking at, how do we get stuff up and running? It's how do we keep things up and running?
Yeah, it's
And the
definitely. Oh, sorry, go on, Matthews, please.
No, I would just like to add also one aspect. So from a city perspective, of course, I mean the city has the duty to serve all its citizens, and we can clearly see that the less income, the less wealth you have, the more affected you are typically by such adverse events. So if you have a strong heat and you can't afford your AC for your house, then of course you're in a much worse position. And the same is also true for the whole mobility situation. So I think that is also important to keep in mind when we talk about measures and strategies, that we also should make equity analysis and say, for example, you build a shelter that can be used to protect people against heat or cold. So either of those purposes are a very very usual. Then you can make an accessibility analysis first and see where you place it in terms of the modes of mobility that are relevant for the people that you actually want to serve. So this is then the point where you can make much better, much more informed decision when you have the right tools, the right software available, the right data available, to basically generate a big, much bigger impact with the same budget that you would spend in other places, maybe a lot less effective.
Great points, Matthias. Yeah, accessibility and equity towards resources and facilities to address kind of resiliency mitigation measures. And to kind of expand upon Mike's point, which I thought was great, is in terms of the proclivity and expansion of job titles and roles in the public sector of more so mid to large size US cities. We're seeing quite a recent trend on that front in terms of chief resiliency officers. I believe Phoenix or Tucson has a chief heat officer. I believe even Miami might have that. So the job titles are changing, but they all have the same theme just in the last few years. And you can see that whether or not these is a repositioning of kind of the organizational structure or a new focus in an added, let's say, core capacity towards municipal governance, it is quite encouraging because of this emphasis of protecting all of our systems, soft and hard, infrastructure and everything in future proofing for short-term shocks, like Matthew said, and long-term, let's say, slow-moving events. And I think that this is something that we all need to consider. And it's good that the public sector and municipal governments, I'm not quite seeing at the state level, although I believe there's a few states, New York State and others, that are starting to include that in their nomenclature. But I think really where the action is at right now, where it's really exciting, is local and regional governments in the United States with not just the job title changes, but a lot of the new programs and policies in place, funded programs. So with that, let's kind of move on to our next topic, which is around smarter mobility and community protection. So Mike, maybe if you want to give us a quick perspective on how intelligent transportation systems can enhance urban resilience.
Yeah, so a lot of agencies, cities nowadays, they use video detection to detect vehicles coming to an intersection and give them the green light to pass through. But a lot of these detection systems, be it video, radar, they also have the capability to record and provide a lot of data. So we got to start looking at, aside from just detecting vehicles, can we use the infrastructure that we already have out there, the hardware that we have out there, can we do something else with that data to help with this whole resiliency thing, right? We can't just keep installing new items over and over and over. We can look at what we already have. Are we using this data that we're getting to the max of its capabilities? Is there something else we can do here? Can we look at this data to learn video feeds? Can we see why these areas are prone to fires or theft or anything like that? There's equipment that we already have out there that I'm sure we're not making use the full making full use of the capabilities of that we can be looking at. And aside from that, when we do put in new equipment, we kind of got to think into the future too. Does this equipment serve our needs now, or can it also serve what we're going to need in the future? If our city is going to expand and grow and we're going to see more people living here, is this going to be adequate for when that time comes, or are we going to have to replace it again? Right? I think resiliency goes hand in hand with sustainability. At some point in the future, maybe 100 years from now, 200 years from now, we're going to run out of material to build new things. So we got to kind of have to look at what can we do now? What can we build now that kind of pushes forward into the future so that we're not having to replace equipment every 5 years, every 10 years? We want to do something that lasts a little longer to help with. To be more resilient and more sustainable.
And to repurpose existing infrastructure by maybe making more incremental add-on changes versus completely replacing, like you had mentioned, every 3 or 4 or 5 years, which one is just capital intensive, and two, it just goes it's diametrically opposed to the policy directions and choices that cities are trying to make. So Matthias, maybe you care to weigh in on this topic.
Yeah, I would like to bring the technology word now from the operations, where you have a lot of physical technology, more to the planning side, where you have algorithms as the core technology. But I think they also play a very crucial role because I mentioned it at the beginning already. Resilience is a lot about being prepared and not having to improvise, but really knowing about plan A, B, C, and D. And that is, of course, where a good planning and analysis tools come into play. So you can really test evacuation scenario, for example, under different circumstances. You can it's a completely different thing if you say you want to make something in rush hour on a work day, or maybe it's a weekend day in a fun area where people everybody goes to a lake or something. So then you need to accommodate for different scenarios, and the planning tools just help you to give you that virtual environment where you test out and know about what you should do before you are in the position that you actually have to do it. And that is the very important thing where you can really also foresee when you would need to inform which kind of endangered people or even identifying them. I know that we were talking about California, for example. I know that there's legislation that requires to make analysis to find people in hazard areas that only have two or less potential routes to evacuate from that area. And as soon as you have one route blocked, then it's a super strict bottleneck then you have. And of also that legislation then requires to make capacity analysis. And from such proactive measures, you can then say, well, okay, we found out that really on this route capacity is not good enough. And maybe there can be simple solutions like having a dedicated signal timing plan for evacuation, or maybe it's just a rebuild of a few intersections that used to be stop sign and now they are roundabout for higher capacity or something. So it can be really small measures when you act proactively to prevent a lot bigger damage in case of emergency.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the California legislation was a response or reaction to the 2017 2018 Paradise Fire, which was near Chico, California, Northern California, where many residents were trapped in this kind of isolated forested community in the upper Sierra Nevada mountains, where there was only like one access point, one ingress and egress. And you know, some of these challenges are limited by the built environment and just the street network. But I believe I completely agree with you. There are technologies we can use to help with the integration of timing, access, and maybe facilitating the infrastructure that we do have to, let's say, promote the precedence of first responders and others that would need to get on time with the highest level of priority. So that we don't have these strict bottlenecks, because these recent events that have happened have triggered a lot of cause for concern in how maybe more rural and let's say districts that are not quite as accessible do need better facilities and access. So with that, let's kind of maybe move on to our next kind of topic around smarter mobility and community protection. Matthias, maybe if you just also want to weigh in on this, is maybe if you want to share some examples for us on some innovative mobility solutions that you've seen specifically within the domain of resilient cities and resilient planning.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about innovative mobility, everybody today thinks about some drones flying around and stuff like that. But from my perspective, you don't really have to go to that, I would say, rare maybe modes in the future, but the true innovation is really by making that a strongly interconnected network. So I believe the more modes you have available, of course, the more resilient you are. So you have a roadblock, no problem. You just take the train, and or maybe you go on your bike and you use that kind of infrastructure. So it really, it's often it's not even that technology heavy, but it's m more about offering alternatives that can be used as plan B or C in that case. And of course, when we're talking about the technology side, then Mike already mentioned we have technology to prioritize certain movements. So this is a lot about modern communication technology. It's about vehicles talking to the infrastructure and receiving information back. It's about cloud backbones that allow for prioritization along corridors. So definitely those are important aspects. And of course, you can't make any talk about innovation in 2025 without the elephant in the room, AI. So of course, AI is a strong tool that can help us, for example, in analytics of live data, using knowledge about patterns to identify problems while they are still very small or just starting. And so you can take proactive measures to keep your mobility system stable and operating, because typically you know from patterns, if you would let this run without taking a measure, then you run into real problems. But normally when you react very early, then you can still basically, like with a fire, when it's still small, it's a lot easier to fight against it than getting it big. And the same is true when you have proactive traffic management that use such strong analytics and have the capability to look a little bit into the future.
Great. Thank you, Mathis.
Yeah.
So, Mike, what are your thoughts on some examples of innovative
Yeah, I
modalities?
think Thais hit on a great point there. Traditional technology and systems that have been put in place, they kind of just kind of cater to cars and passenger vehicles, right? But we're starting to see a lot of more different modes of transportation. We're seeing micromobility, e-scooters, e-bikes. A lot of people are now into a green lifestyle where they're walking more. So we got to be looking at systems that kind of expand beyond just looking at cars and how do we protect cars and start looking at how do we protect everybody on the street, the pedestrians, the bicyclists, the guy on the e-scooter, the people walking their dogs. A lot of systems nowadays, they're starting to develop that capability. For example, at Econolite, in the past, our traditional video detection system and radar system, they kind of just look at cars, but now we're incorporating machine learning and neural networks to try to expand that to be able to differentiate between a car, a bike, a guy walking on the street, a pedestrian who wants to cross the street. So using technology that way, expanding our technology to be able to serve all of our community and not just a small subset of it, like we traditionally have in the past, I think that's going to be really big in creating a resilient transportation system.
Not only the future, but I always say the present is multimodal. So it's here now in 2025. And it's
Absolutely.
not even just in Europe. It's starting to take hold in North America, in US and Canada. Europe has been always traditionally a bit more multimodal, but we're seeing it across the globe right now. And the opportunities abound for different tools and technologies to provide that granularity, that insight, that level of detail required beyond traditional 20th century autocentric urban planning, transportation planning. We've gone so far, especially since the pandemic. In my view, and I'm writing a book on this right now, and I'll plug this for everyone, Cities First, Urbanism and Mobility in the Post-COVID City. What is the post-COVID city? The post-COVID city is multimodal. It is third places. It is, moving away from the standard AM, PM, cyclical commute traffic patterns. It's almost post CBD, post downtown. We're seeing a repurpose of land use, from just specifically commercial and retail to housing, in downtown San Francisco and LA and all these places. So, all these different mixes of modes of planning and transportation systems lend themselves to a rich tapestry for this granularity and this dissection of how different generations and let's talk about the generational shifts now. If we're talking about Gen Z, we're talking about millennials, Gen Alpha. A lot of them aren't even owning cars anymore. And this is even the United States, but it's even more so in Europe and especially Northern Europe. So, the preferences, the consumer habits are changing since COVID so that people really want to have the freedom of choice, not the freedom of the automobile, but the freedom of choice. So, how are we going to do that? How are we going to plan and deliver cities and built environments to actually accommodate these preferences, these choices? Through granularity and through insights that isn't traditional top-down 20th century autocentric urban planning vis-a-vis Robert Moses, New York City. So we need to move away from this very 1950s, 1940s worldview to something that re is relevant for 2025 and Gen Z and millennials. But I went off a little tangent, but I think it hits to what you guys are talking about towards more opportunities for AI technologies to present this realistic picture of where we're at, where we're going to be, not just a copy paste of where we were 60, 70 years ago after World War II. Because that urban paradigm model is outdated and it's irrelevant now. So cities function differently. Do you guys want to weigh on that?
Yeah, I think you brought up a brilliant point here. I mean, at the end, we can even take it a step forward and talk about the ideal of the 15-minute city. So a city where everything you need for your daily life is reachable within 15 minutes of walking. Then, of course, that is automatically super resilient in terms of if car traffic breaks down, well, you still reach everything you would need from the groceries and so on within 15 minutes of walking. So that is definitely a big attractor. And of course, what we see a lot here, I mean, I'm dialed in from Germany, so speaking for the European perspective, we see a lot of conversion going on where we take away a lane that was dedicated for car traffic. So you had two lanes for the cars. Now you have one lane for the cars, one for the bikes, or even you free up some space that you can now use to plant something. So make the city more livable, make it greener. And that is also definitely something that helps you from a sustainability perspective, shifting to the modes, but also freeing up that space that helps for resilience against the heat, for example. So we're having big discussions about cities that have basically too much stones and rocks that would just heat up, and now they are building trees again, and having something green that would actually help to keep the temperature down, and get everybody a better life in that city.
Yeah, the urban heat island effect, as we always say. And the 15-minute city is something that we urbanists have studied for years, but it's a bit of a new label on a traditional town and urban planning concept, which is basically kind of pre-industrial revolution, getting back to kind of pedestrian and cycle and pre-automobile locomotion. Mike, I'd love to get maybe your take on this now that we're kind of on this topic. You're in Anaheim, maybe some examples even in Orange County. I know they got the Great Park going on in Irvine. I used to live right down the road from there. Some interesting urban planning, concepts going on near the El Toro Y off the 405 and the 5 freeway. But, even downtown Anaheim has some really cool stuff going on and some mixed use. I know near the Honda Center, right near the Santa Ana River by Disneyland, they're doing a really interesting mixed use project off the 5 freeway. Maybe what are some interesting things that you're seeing in the backyard of Econolite that you think are kind of promoting multimodality? Just in Orange County.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think here a lot of cities and agencies are putting more focus in their active transportation plan. So we're seeing a lot more mixed use developments in Costa Mesa, which is about 20 minutes from here. We're seeing them repurposing an area that used to be a dead mall, and they're going to turn that into a mixed use area. And we're seeing a lot of, as part of these plans, we're seeing them put a lot of parks up where it's pedestrian friendly, green friendly. So I think that's where a lot of agencies are looking and going towards. And here, people like to copy each other, right? Anaheim and Los Angeles are the two biggest cities in the Southern California, Orange County area. And a lot of agencies around here kind of look to them to see what are they doing. And thankfully, I think Anaheim and LA are pretty progressive cities in terms of how do we look forward. In LA, it's a little harder to do because you already have so much development that are set the way they are. But in places like Anaheim, Costa Mesa, Santa Ana, whenever these new projects come up, there's more focus on mixed use and not just, building office buildings and building things that you can really only get to from a vehicle. Because being multimodal, just having multiple ways to get to where you need to go, that in itself lends itself to resiliency, right? If something breaks down, you have a myriad of other ways that you can use to get what you need. So that's what I'm seeing around here.
Yeah, I mean, back to South Orange County, what we saw in the 1970s and 80s were kind of traditional commercial office parks like near John Wayne Airport and all that stuff. Now, a lot of the new greenfield or repurposed developments include traffic calming measures, they include roundabouts, they include road diets. Like Mathieu said, they include a lot more softscaping. They're using a lot of the techniques actually that were conceived in the Netherlands, the Woonerf, the living street, to use the Dutch term. And these are being implemented even in American and US kind of mixed use, large scale developments on a bit of an incremental scale. They're kind of testing it out. It's not necessarily the entire city. And we're seeing, like neighbor on the neighborhood level in terms of kind of new transportation projects, even in Los Angeles with the introduction of new BRT, bus rapid transit corridors, this kind of introduction of squeezing out parking, like Mathieu said, and everything. There's a brand new BRT corridor that's going to be running. I forget the name of it, but LA Metro is running it from Pasadena to North Hollywood along the 134 freeway in Eagle Rock. And these are really interesting concepts that I think promote multimodality and not only, let's say, encourage the use of public transit, but other lighter modes that could complement kind of traditional transportation modes. So it's a really exciting time to see what's being implemented by city just in the last 5 years.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they're doing this at a time where they're also thinking about resiliency, right? We talked about having these chief resiliency officers in place. These guys, I hope that they're involved in these projects and also a part of it and have their spot on the table where they can, bring in a lot of these concepts that we're talking about as we develop these projects, so that we don't end up in the same place that we were 15 years ago when all said and done.
Yeah, because it's one thing to have a resilient building, but if a resilient building is surrounded by acres and acres of, asphalt, or if a resilient building is by a 10-lane boulevard or a freeway, or if you have a resilient park, but it's surrounded by old concrete materials, I mean, the resiliency has to factor in all three dimensions of
Right.
softscape, hardscape, roads, buildings, the entire built environment. So one would imagine, one would hope that cities in the United States and in Europe, under this resiliency umbrella, are factoring in all these different interconnected physical elements. Of course, with a strong emphasis on mobility. One advantage we have here in Europe, Mike, that is not in the US, is we have the SUMP, the Sustainable Urban Mobility Plan, which the US doesn't have, which is a bit more coordinated around the central theme of mobility to tie in all the threads of urban development versus kind of the traditional US urban planning process, which is where you have a separate chapter for housing, a separate chapter for land use, a separate chapter for economic development. But I'm not saying that that is something that could be a new potential, let's say, innovation in the United States. However, it's interesting that mobility is a central theme and of our topic of resiliency that ties all these different components together. So, whether or not it's part of the traditional transportation land use planning process or not, it's something we should all think about. In terms of being comprehensive, though, from my perspective. I don't know if you guys
Yeah,
have
I
some
think it's
thoughts
going
on
to
that as
require
well,
a
too.
mindset change,
Yeah.
especially here in America, right? We're very car-centric here, and that's going to require a mindset shift away from that. And that's going to be really hard to do. It's not going to happen overnight, but slowly and surely, but all these projects and measures, and hopefully over time, we'll start to see that shift towards multimodal networks that are able to support more than just cars. And then if we can shift our daily use away from, I need a car to get where I need to go. Into, I can take my bike, I can take this train. Hey, this bus now goes on this route that takes me to work. That's going to go a long way in the future.
It's a
We
mindset
just got to start now.
shift. You spot on, and we need to move away from these silos, these individual domains, to something that's interconnected. Sorry, Matthias.
I think the important word here is change. So at the end, change is always difficult. We are all creatures of habit, so we do what we do every day, and repeating is a lot easier than starting something new. So in the end, to make a change happen, it's about I would say always about push and pull and the delicate combination. So have as much pulling forces towards more attractive new modes, maybe multimodality, maybe using the bike because you have an attractive infrastructure, you have something built that makes it easier for you, and at the same time also pushing a little bit. And I think the conversion of a lane is a perfect example for a push and pull at the same time because it's a pull towards cycling. You make it more attractive for the cyclists. At the same time, you reduce the capacity for the car. So using the car is getting more unattractive. And of course, simulation can help you to evaluate how much that would actually mean in terms of capacity reduction before you do it. And but at the end, you need them both because I always say we are like water. So we search for the easiest path down the hill. And if you change the built environment a little bit and the circumstances, then the easiest path down the hill is maybe by bike in the future and not by car anymore, because from my perspective, my daily commute to work, basically it's the same time if I take the car or if I take the bike, because we have such a good cycling infrastructure here in Karlsruhe, and that is of course the result of decades of dedicated planning for that. And but you can see it clearly reflected in the modal split with around, I think, 40% of the trips done by bike and active modes. That is, it didn't come from nowhere. It just requires some dedication and some endurance. And what you also mentioned, the sustainable urban mobility plans, that is, of course, a similar approach on, let's say, a very very high level, because it couples the additional funding you get to this way of holistic thinking. So if you can do it from your own budget as a city, you can still do it however you want. But if you want to have funding from the levels above, then you need to fulfill certain criteria. And this is again setting the incentive. You get extra money when you do it in a sustainable way. So, well, maybe let's do it this way. And my final thought is on this topic here. We should also always just think in terms of resilience and sustainability for stuff that we have to do anyway, and especially thinking very far ahead when we build infrastructure that will really last very long. So, for example, when you build a bridge right now, it will probably be around in 2100. So you should not only build it for the requirements you have today, but you should try to foresee what requirements you have there. And of course, we have been talking about rising sea level and stuff like that, or the higher likelihood of heavy rain events. So maybe you already think about another drainage system or level it up a little bit. And this is, from today's perspective, such a minor additional invest that you would have to take, but it will save a lot of money from maybe having to rebuild everything in 30, 40, 50 years down the road, because then you realize it just doesn't fit to the changing environment anymore.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Mike, would you care to expand upon that a bit? Do you have any other
Yeah, I think
thoughts?
that's a great point. We have to get away from the mindset of 50 years from now, that's somebody else's problem, right? And we're working on it now. This is what we want to deal with. I'm going to retire at 10 years. It won't be my problem. Then somebody else can deal with it. We got to get away from that mindset to be, in order to be sustainable and resilient, we have to think about, we have to care about what our children's going to have to deal with in their timeline, right? How do we build today without taking away their ability to do what they need in the future? How do we build this still to last so that they can also use it and not have to redo it and come up with a solution on their own later on? So those are my thoughts. A lot of it is mindset and change, right? We have a certain way of thinking things. It's human nature. We're kind of born to think, what do I need to do to survive? But we kind of have to think more broadly and more on a societal level. How do we keep our cities going into the future? When I'm long gone, how do I make sure that these guys have what they need to keep my city going? How do I leave a legacy for them?
Yeah, and like I said, this is just an opinion, not a fact, but I do believe the onset of the COVID pandemic was a break point, though. It was a change, a paradigm shift in how we view how cities function and plan. And it provided an opportunity during that crisis mode for the first few months here in Europe, but somewhat in the US too, to start experimenting with more traditional forms of urban design and intervention, whether they be pop-up bike lanes, whether they be car-free streets, corona pathways, etc. So we had all these different tools that we were experimenting with, and there was this, well, I mean, it was, obviously, we all know, the experience we went through, but I would say that was the one silver lining, at least for urbanists, was that after about 60 or 70 years of being marginalized and going through kind of the traditional auto-centric, copy-paste, top-down transportation planning methodology since the Second World War, and even before, probably starting in the 1920s, because that's when most state highway departments were founded in the United States, Caltrans, Minnesota, etc. It's been gone for over 100 years now of this very kind of traditional mindset of road building and circulation and the movement of vehicles, not humans. That a lot of these different, let's say, concepts and schemes were given a little bit of latitude to try out on a neighborhood level, not on a city level, but to get back to Matthias's theme of the 15-minute city. That's where the 15-minute city started gaining steam, was during the COVID lockdowns and after. That's when it started in 2020, because we didn't really hear about it that much before that. And that is really where we saw a big movement and a shift in mindset. Albeit, I agree with what you're saying, Mike. There is inertia and there's resistance. A lot of that is institutional. A lot of that is generational too, though. If we're talking about Gen X boomers, not sure. They're probably gonna dig in their heels. We're talking about younger generations. They're a bit more open and they are adopting these new modalities. And a lot of them are starting to work for city councils, governments, and for the private sector. So I don't want to be too, unrealistic, but that does give me hope. And I see there's some tangible results of tactical urbanism and do-it-yourself, let's say, changes to streets to infrastructure that are be done low cost, some with funding of sump, some done on neighbor level, but most to your point, Matthias, is with a blended let's say connection to the sump, only because there's 256 sumps in Europe and counting. So cities would only do themselves a disservice by trying to do this in isolation. So most of them are complying with those guidelines to prepare a sump, and they're on board because really they know that it's not like, let's say, it's free money, but it is really a logical framework to plan and organize your city. And it's really the cost of either doing business or governing and managing a city that has become the accepted norm now. So what might have been an outlier before COVID or 10, 15 years ago in terms of smaller cities and outlying regions that maybe didn't want to be part of this kind of overarching planning framework, the ones I'm talking, the ones I'm working with, because I do a lot of my work here in Europe, but in the US too, they're all on board now. And they're totally fine with the sump framework, not only because of the financial incentives, but because they agree with the policies and let's say goals and objectives that the cities already have in their own, let's say, political governance process. Albeit, though, we're going through a little bit of a political disruption at the municipal level in Europe and in the US right now. So things are changing, but there is a strong push towards this decarbonization of the transport sector and improving our built environment.
I would catch your thought in between. So you were talking a lot about how COVID triggered structural change, and I would say a very big change was also about not how we move, but why we move, or if we move at all. Because
Yeah.
typically on a Monday
Maybe
morning, I
no
don't wake
movement.
up and say, I want to ride my bike or I want to drive a car, but I say, I need to work. And that used to be, I need to get to work, but today it's really, I need to work. So I have my laptop with me, I can work from home, I can, and that is, of course, a much underestimated from in many perspectives element also of resilience we are talking about here. So it's actually not needed for many of the purposes that we needed to have physical transportation. That's not needed anymore today. So even if your network is overloaded, well, then you just stay where you are and you can still accomplish the job you have to be accomplished. And I would say with the distribution of many people regularly working remotely. Today, we see just less load on the same road structure. So that also gives us a little bit of flexibility to deal with unexpected events.
Absolutely. So maybe we'll just kind of wrap it up here with a few minutes left, but maybe some final words, Mike, on what is the current and future outlook for resiliency in cities and how we can plan for the future.
Yes, Scott, I think you hit on a great point in your previous remarks, and that a lot of it is generational. I think that is definitely for sure. An example I had is, and I won't name the specific cities, not to throw anyone under the bus, but we recently had a city who had a traffic cabinet knocked down got hit by a vehicle, right? So they had to replace it, and they use an old TS1 spec that was the put out in the 1970s. And the traffic engineer kind of just said, all right, let's put another TS1 cabinet
Sure.
there when there are so many
Status
newer
quo.
technologies, TS2,
Right.
ATC. And
That's
I'm
right.
like, why? This is your opportunity to build back better, to build forward, to bounce
Yes.
forward. But no, they're like, well, we don't want to train our staff. We don't want to learn
If
this
it
new
ain't
thing.
broke, don't fix it. That's what we
If it ain't
Americans
broke,
say.
don't fix it, even though it is broke.
It
Let's just
is
replace
broke,
it
yeah.
with the old thing, right? And that's not the right mindset to have. Whereas with the newer generations, we're seeing a lot more willingness to explore newer technologies that's available, right? They're inviting us in to talk about, okay, we see that there's this new ATC cabinet spec. What's that all about? What kind of benefits do we have? How does that future-proof us? And that's the kind of conversations that kind of drive this forward and help build into resiliency. Let's not keep doing the things we always have been doing. Just because it's the way we've always done it doesn't mean it's the way we always need to do it, right? Let's look for new and improved ways. And a lot of agencies are starting to move in that direction, and that's good. We just got to keep that momentum going forward.
That's very encouraging to hear. Yeah, and we need to start thinking for the future. So Matthias, maybe some final thoughts on the current and future outlook for resiliency in cities and kind of the technology and policy landscape?
I think the main message from my side is use the intelligence you can get from smart planning, from evaluations to make smart decisions. I don't even want to say which policy goal you need to set because they are different in the world, but make informed decisions. So get away from gut decisions, but really take it into digital twins, virtual representations, however you want to call it, to foresee on basis of KPI, foresee in a data-driven way what plan A or plan B would actually mean, and then make informed decisions how to go forward and hopefully in a consistent way. And hopefully, of course, in a strategy that leads you to a sustainable and resilient future. But at least be conscious about what you're doing and not experiment around.
Exactly. So, with that, I'd like to thank our guests, Matthias and Mike. It's been a really sincere pleasure. I really enjoyed this dialogue. It gives me a lot of hope for the future, a lot of things to unpack, a lot of institutional barriers, a lot of technology gaps. But the learnings that we have can definitely guide us forward to build more resilient, stronger, and sustainable cities. So, from your both perspectives, from PTV and Econolite, I really appreciate that. So, thanks for joining us today on this topic. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Scott. It
Thank
was
you
our
very
pleasure.
much.
Yeah. So, with that, just want to thank everyone. Again, this episode was sponsored by PTV Group, Econolite, Imovity. Our next episode, we're going to have a podcast at the end of September. We're going to talk about digital twins and city and regional planning. So, that'll be really exciting. So, stay tuned on that. And once again, I just wanted to thank Matthias and Mike for your time, and maybe we'll have you guys on again in the near future.
Sounds good. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. Would be a pleasure.